It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Later this hour, we'll check out the prospect of Apple TV and how it could change the way we get our home entertainment fix.
But first, our next guest has been a campaign fundraiser and advisor for a bunch of female lawmakers over the years. She's here with a message to women. Get out there and run for office.
Rebecca Sive is the author of the book Every Day is Election Day, a woman's guide to winning any office from the PTA to the White House. And Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here on Women's Equality Day.
I was going to say it, but you got there first. So tell me, why should we care about this right now, that there aren't as many women, for example, in Congress as there are men by a long shot?
Well, because having women in public office matters. It matters to women and their families. It matters to the world in general. And I think that what we've seen historically is that when women become legislators, in particular, they focus on issues that matter to women's lives, like matters of, you know, sexual violence and abuse and equal pay and equal opportunity. So on the issues, it really matters. And secondly, you know, we know just from our own lives that many women have dreams of public leadership and political leadership, and, you know, because there have been barriers to that, have not been able to realize those dreams. So just like men should be able to realize their dreams of public leadership, women should too.
Rebecca, what do you think is holding women back from running for office?
Well, historically, you know, what held women back, I mean, sort of way back in the day, was we were on an unequal footing, and we celebrate that more equal footing today. And, you know, then there started to be a change in attitudes a couple of decades ago. Certainly the so-called Year of the Woman showed that women could run and win in considerable numbers in high offices. Historically, the other thing that's gone on is that women have at times held a different standard up to whether they're ready to seek public office than men have. So, for instance, women wonder more than men do whether they're qualified or whether they'll be able to raise the money or whether they can manage, you know, family issues, and it's, or whether they know enough about the issues that the job entails dealing with, whereas men more often come at it and say, gee whiz, it looks like being a state senator is a cool thing to do, and I think I can help. Let me go do it. You know, and the woman worries about whether she can meet the job description. So historically, those have been some of the factors, but I think that's also starting to change.
Well, I'd like to think you're right, and yet there is a story in today's New York Times about how the Obama administration has named no more women to high-level executive branch posts than the Clinton administration did, and that was two decades ago.
Right. You know, I don't think, certainly my own experience in this work teaches me this, that we don't get anywhere without pushing really hard. And so while it's true that overall women hold more higher-level positions than, say, they did in decades previously, we can't assume that that will just happen. And it's unfortunately the case that no matter who's president or who's the CEO, we have to push hard, you know, lean in and push back really hard, because historically it's just been very easy for senior people to select men who, on the face of it, perhaps have been more in the mix or appear to be better qualified because they started younger or just because they don't know them and they don't think about them.
So can you make the case for women listening right now, why should they get out there and run for public office?
Well, first of all, there are thousands of women who have that dream. And so my message to them in this book, and just as often as I can say it, is follow your dream. So if that's a dream you have, then do it. I think the other case is that it matters when women sit at the table, the decision-making table. I can tell you from my own experience, going back, you know, a few years, that in a couple of instances, I was the only woman at that political table. And to have had other women there changes the discussion, changes the dynamic, demonstrates the strength and smarts that women have. So in the first place, I think that the more diversity there is at any decision-making table, you know, the better off we'll be. And secondly, as I said a moment ago, it's when women hold office that those issues that matter so much to women get taken seriously and laws are passed and rules are put in place to help women.
Well, your book is an advice book for women who are running for public office, from the PTA to the White House, because I'm assuming you're thinking, you know, you've got to start somewhere, so you might as well, if you start small, you might keep working your way up. But what are some of the first things a woman needs to know about herself if she's considering running for office of some kind?
Well, first of all, I would say that while the title of the book is From the PTA to the White House, what I'm really hoping to communicate there is, number one, every position of public leadership is important. And secondly, there are a lot of different routes or rungs on the ladder, if that's what you choose to do. But I think that in terms of looking at yourself and making some sort of self-assessment, I have a chapter at the beginning of the book, which is sort of a what I call the personality self-test. And in there, I talk about whether you possess certain attributes. For instance, whether you know, on the one hand, like power and doing good things with it, because that's what being in public office is about. And on the other hand, in a very different dimension, you know, do you like eating corn dogs and, you know, meeting and greeting people all over the place all the time? But there's a series of characteristics there, and they're prefaced by the notion that unless you really, really want it, you know, dreams don't just come true because you dream them. You really have to work at it. And there's one very telling quote in the book from a federal judge, Alana Rovner, who was the first woman on the U.S. Court of Appeals in the Seventh Circuit. And when I talked with her about how she just kept at it all those years and finally, you know, and prevailed, she said, raw, pure desire. So that's probably the first thing. And then the second thing is, will you work like the Dickens? And then going from there.
What about wanting to wield power? Because it seems as though if you just take a cross-section of society, you're going to see more men who say that they're interested in power.
Right.
Do women need to change something in the way they think about power? I mean, it's not necessarily bad to want power, right?
No, it's not bad, because if you have power, you can do good things for people, and there's no higher calling than that. And, you know, that's really the point, you know, a major point in the book, that you know, people misconstrue that notion or think that those who apply power but without any sort of concern for others are the only people, is the only way to be powerful. But that's not true. And so I really encourage women, you know, to think about the role that public institutions have in our lives, whether we live in little towns or big cities, and the power that comes with them. I can tell you that I gave a speech recently in Michigan, and it was women from all over the state, you know, rural, urban, and one woman who'd been an office manager for years said she went to the county board meeting. This is a rural county somewhere in northern Michigan, and she watched the county clerk, and she said, I can do that. Now, in that county, as in many counties, the county clerk is a very powerful person, and she now is a county clerk. So, yes, I absolutely encourage women to think about how they can help make our world a better place by holding positions of influence.
Do you have to be able to take a hit and then maybe to hit back if you're attacked?
Oh, absolutely, yes. You know, it's it goes with the territory. And one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, how not to take that personally, how to take the measure of the hit, so to speak, and figure out what to do, how to make sure that you have a consistent and, you know, very loyal base of supporters who will come to your side when and if you take a hit. And last, most importantly, if the hit is big enough, so to speak, that you lose, how to bounce back. And I really also advocate for women not to, well, gee, I lost this one. That means I can't do it. I'm going back, you know, sit in a corner somewhere. I really encourage women to, you know, get up off the floor, dust yourself off, and get back in the ring.
We're talking to Rebecca Sive about her book, Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide to Winning Any Office, from the PTA to the White House. And we'd love to hear from you on this Women's Equality Day. Why do you think there aren't as many women interested in running for office? At least there don't seem to be. And what needs to happen to change that? And if you yourself have run for office and you're a woman, what was that like? What kind of experience did you have? And what would you tell your daughters coming up about why it's important? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or post your comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're picking up a conversation with Rebecca Sive right now. She's the author of Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide to Winning Any Office, from the PTA to the White House. And we welcome your calls about why we haven't seen equal numbers, for instance, of women and men in Congress, why we don't see as many women governors as we do male governors. What's holding women back, do you think, and what needs to change? Our number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. And let's go to Pam in Fish Creek now. Hi, Pam.
Hi. Hi. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. Good. Doing very well. I really find this topic fascinating. I was part of a group this summer that went through a kind of what they call a little bit of a it was like a four-hour class about trying to encourage women to run for local office, whether it was local, state, whatever, but to get involved in politics. And I found it, I was just fascinated by it. So I'm thinking now, but part of what I'm daunted by, I guess I would say, is really one, is the whole idea and process of asking for money and raising funds in order to, you know, to launch a campaign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the second item is that these days our election process, or at least the process of running for office, has gotten really ugly with so much mudslinging and name calling. I think that also, I'm not sure I want to put myself out in that particular way. I think you have to have a certain certain thickness of skin, and I'm not sure all women have that. Or have that thick of a skin or want to put themselves out there in that particular way.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pam. That's an interesting interesting call that so many women, I imagine, feel a lot like Pam do, that it sounds good, but raising money is daunting. And, you know, can we really put ourselves out there and expose ourselves to that much negativity?
Yeah. Well, you know, they're really good points, Pam. I'm glad you raised them. And, you know, a couple of things on that. And first of all, I'm delighted that you all did that work together this summer. I hope you follow through. You know, on the fundraising front, I would encourage you to think about the other kinds of fundraising that odds are you and other women you work with have already done. I mean, women are the backbone of fundraising for charitable organizations, for churches, for worthy causes, for Girl Scouts, you name it, in most communities across the country. I mean, we know how to do this. And, you know, what I say in the book, and I have a long chapter on fundraising, actually, is encouraging women to think about fundraising as organizing, because what you're, and educating, because what you're really doing is you're talking to people and saying to them, this is the project I want to take on. Here's why I want to do it. Here's why it's important to us and to our community. In order to make that happen, I need your financial support. And when put that way, you know, what people, number one, it's what you're trying to do. And number two, you're really asking people to become investors in something that's worth doing in the community. So I really encourage thinking about it that way, as opposed to, gee whiz, I'm asking you, Jane, to put, you know, money in my pocket. That's not what you're asking that person to do, of course. The second thing, as to the sort of, you know, the back and forth, you know, I heard this statistic the other day that close to a majority of members of local school boards across the country are women. And those women are putting themselves, you know, on the line in the public eye every day of the week on matters that sometimes are quite controversial. So, and I think that occasionally they are criticized. I actually tell the story in my book of one woman, Aiden Myrie, who was vice president of the school board in Helena, Montana, and I talk about what she went through. And she really talks about how she concluded at the, you know, she was called names. There were people who disagreed with what the school board was trying to do. But she said she felt so strongly, you know, about what they were trying to do for the children in her school that it was worth it. And so I also encourage you to think about it that way, that, you know, if people disagree on issues, they can be very vociferous. But that doesn't mean that you're wrong or that it has anything to do with you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Pam, and good luck to you. And let's move on to Ruth in Eau Claire. Hi, Ruth.
Yeah, I'm, you know, my comment is that women need to see themselves as being able to access, or girls, young women, being able to access any level of administration, not just in politics, although, I mean, I think how we get them there is if they see themselves as capable of any sort of administrative or higher level position within the community that would then lead to women seeing themselves as more capable, able to do legislation. I know locally here we have a great big billboard that's posted all over the community for one of the local banks, and there's like 6 or 7 men and one woman in this bank ad. And, you know, what if it were 6 or 7 women and one man? Mm-hmm. I mean, we just wouldn't see that today. But at least there was one woman in the group. I was glad to see that. But I do look at that, and it is daunting to say, what do women have access to? You know,
right.
When
and
you
what
see
about
all those men posted up there and one woman, it's not a good message in the community.
And what about that, Rebecca? Do we just need to get out there and then start to see ourselves as leaders?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, it's, and Ruth is right, it's terribly important that women assert themselves in whatever sorts of public leadership positions they're interested in and are in their community. And, for instance, you know, the local bank can be very, very important for, you know, lots of obvious reasons. And sometimes when women seek positions in the business sector, they then see what the broader issues are in the community and then decide, gee whiz, I also want to be, you know, the head of the local civic association or something like that. So these kinds of positions can be paired, and they lead to learning about public issues. And so while it's daunting, you know, I kind of come back to this, you know, kind of not so what, but gee whiz, you know, gee whiz, we have a role to play. We know what we're doing. The laws have changed so that we're on somewhat of a more equal footing. So, yes, why not go forward? And, you know, if it takes a while to achieve parity or something like that, you know, my view is that every one woman matters, and I talk about this in my book, so that, you know, if the bank board has 2 women on it instead of 1, that's a really good thing. And, you know, let's now go look at this board and that board and the next one and just, you know, keep pushing to make those changes.
Well, I want to ask you, and we've got about a minute left here, but I want to ask you about Sheryl Sandberg and her Lean In motto and her feeling that, you know, women really need to try harder to force their way to the top. Is leaning in really going to change the situation for women?
Well, I'm an advocate of leaning in and pushing back, to your earlier point. I don't think that it's been our experience that great strides have been made when women have acted alone. The power that we have to create change that benefits women across the board, and in that context, individual women will benefit, is when we organize as women to push for changes. So yes, absolutely, as an individual in the workforce, you know, each of us should seek what we believe we deserve and call it lean in, but I think that it's really a group effort that is required in tandem with that to see really meaningful change either in the corporate sector or in the political sector.
Okay, well, Rebecca, we're going to leave it there, but I want to thank you so much for joining us, and happy Women's Equality Day.
Same to you. Thanks very much.
That was Rebecca Sive, who's done a lot of fundraising and campaign advising over the years. And she's also the author of the book Every Day is Election Day, A Woman's Guide to Winning Any Office from the PTA to the White House.
Coming up, a look at crime and punishment in Wisconsin and some changes that might be in the works. This is Central Time here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll hear about why Apple may be trying to replace your cable provider.
First, though, we'll talk to WPR reporter Gilman Halstead about new ways that Wisconsin is dealing with those who commit crimes.
State officials met last Friday to discuss possibly expanding a system that offers alternatives to jail time.
Also, local officials are meeting today to consider a new pre-trial screening process that could reform how people are let out on bail.
Gilman, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, let's start off with this conference you were at on Friday, the Treatment Alternatives and Diversion Conference. That was here in Madison. What was that all about?
Well, it was an opportunity for people from around the state, mainly judges, prosecutors, attorneys, and specialty court coordinators, I guess we can call them, drug courts and OWI courts that are multiplying across the state right now, to talk about the successes that they've had and get some encouragement, actually, from state officials like State Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen and Department of Corrections Secretary Ed Wall.
And now, what kind of alternatives are we talking about here?
Well, we're talking about treatment to a large extent, basically mandating treatment instead of locking people up in jail or in prison, where treatment oftentimes is less available, actually, where there are waiting lists. But to mandate people to go into treatment and give, in many cases, give them the opportunity to have a conviction erased if they complete a treatment program and remain drug-free for a certain period of time. So it's both for drugs and for now increasingly for there are OWI courts that are multiplying around the state as well. And they seem to be working. They seem to be saving counties money. And the statistics that were being reported on were pretty impressive. It's only been going on in 8 to 10 counties, and Governor Walker put another $1 million in the budget this year to expand that to maybe another 10 or a dozen counties.
And who's doing this so far around the state?
Well, it's 8 different counties, and it's there are some in the five. It's really all over the state. It's scattered, but the big cities have been. Milwaukee has been doing it. Madison has been doing it. Eau Claire, La Crosse, and some scattered counties up in the north and in the Fox Valley.
I remember when you and the rest of the news team did that series on heroin.
Right.
A theme that kept coming back up is going to prison is not effective heroin treatment. Are we seeing good results from what you heard from the attendees at this conference on getting people off of their addiction to heroin, other drugs, alcohol?
Yeah, and it's it has been effective with a certain population of people who are amenable to treatment. But I think the main thing that's really driving it, Rob, is money. I mean, the amount of money that's being spent to lock people up instead of treatment, that's what we heard a lot about at this conference, was that we've saved $12 million just in these counties over the last 8 years. Some of those statistics, some would argue a little bit with, but we have definitely saved a lot of money. That means that instead of spending in prison $30,000 a year to incarcerate these people, we've been letting them remain in the community and providing treatment for them, which is much less expensive than paying their room and board all day long.
Is everybody in the law enforcement community among these prosecutors and judges buying into this, or is there some pushback?
Well, I have to tell you, I think the majority of law enforcement folks really are. I mean, we had the top law enforcement, chief cop there at the conference, the attorney general, definitely endorsing this. There are a few law enforcement folks around the state, and I guess I would single out, I don't think it's a surprise to many people, that the sheriff of Milwaukee is not a big fan of of these approaches and takes a much more traditional tough-on-crime approach and is suspicious of what he calls social engineering rather than traditional criminal justice.
I know there's been a spate of criminal justice-related news lately. That's part of why we wanted to bring you in today. Another thing that you are reporting on that we thought was interesting is a new approach to the people before they go into a trial. They're in jail. Do they get out on bail? What changes might be in the works there?
Well, we know they're innocent until proven guilty, but once you're charged, often depending on the crime you're charged with, you're going to be asked to post bail unless you look like someone who will come back to trial without doing that, and you get released on personal recognizance. And so they're putting these new systems in place that are called risk assessment screenings, and these have been tested across the country, validated, and judges are now using them and are actually detaining fewer people on lower level, usually nonviolent crimes, and not requiring them to pay bail, and setting up a set of conditions where they have to call in or sometimes wear bracelets to make sure that they come back to trial to determine whether or not they're guilty or not, and then actually get sentenced.
So under the current system, if, knock wood, I'm arrested, I go through the initial processing, they say, okay, Rob, we're going to let you out, but you need to pay a significant amount in, we're going to hold that as a surety to make sure you haul your butt back in here.
Right, and there's less of that going on now. And actually the reform movement going on across the country is trying to eventually get rid of money completely from that bail system and make the decision on whether we're going to hold you in jail or let you out based solely on your risk and not on how much money you can put up.
And how do they – that's got to be an interesting a bit of calculus there. How do you evaluate whether Gil's going to run and Rob's going to stay or vice versa?
Well, traditionally, it's the same way that they would determine a bail amount. I mean, they look at your criminal record. They look at your ties to the community, family, whether or not you have a job. Those are the three main things they're going to look at. But they also may look at whether or not you are a primary provider for the family. Are you the sole do you have custody of a child that you're responsible for?
So something tying you there to the community.
Right, yeah. And something that would actually might be beneficial to the community if they didn't hold you in jail and let you go home and take care of your kid.
Mm-hmm. And are people languishing in jail for long periods of time now because they can't post bail or because the bail amount is too high or non-existent?
No, I don't think there's a lot of long languishing going on. That's been true in other parts of the country. And again, I guess what I would come back to here that the advocates of these reform are focusing on the money involved, that instead of filling that jail cell, which costs a certain amount of money per day to hold someone in, the county is actually saving money by using this different approach to monitoring and assuring that these people who've been arrested and charged with a crime are actually going to show up in court and not commit another crime in between.
Now, who's getting together to talk about this today, and what would be their steps moving ahead?
No. Actually, there's nobody.
Oh, it's not today.
No.
I'm sorry. Okay.
No, that was part of the Friday thing as
Friday.
Well. There were two thrusts to that conference on Friday. One were this treatment and diversion for people who've been convicted, and also this pretrial diversion. So both of those were themes of this,
gotcha.
And they both got encouragement for the most part from you know, the folks in charge of both the prison and the justice system in the state.
One more thing I wanted to ask you about. You've been following stories over the years of police-related shootings, deaths in police custody. I know these are things you're tracking. We're seeing maybe some effort in the state legislature to change the way those cases are reviewed. What is going on there?
Right. Well, there is a system already in place large police departments like Madison, Milwaukee, and I think some of the Green Bay and Eau Claire, when there is a police-involved shooting, they investigate themselves, and they have perhaps the sheriff's department there or the DA's office sort of shadow it. But in other parts, in the smaller police jurisdictions, they'll ask the DOJ to come and do a completely independent one. And there's a move now towards passing a law that would require all police departments to have a completely independent outside investigation of a police officer, of a shooting that's taken place where someone's been killed, because there's a sense that we had these shootings here in Madison, and there have been ones in Milwaukee as well recently, where the public just doesn't trust that a fellow police officer involved in investigating his buddy is going to do a really fair review, and this is to sort of change that perception.
And you've interviewed people in the Madison community on that shooting you mentioned. Is this the sort of thing they've been hoping for from the state legislature?
Yes, I think very much so. And Representative Gary Bies, who's actually a former deputy sheriff from Door County, Republican, has begun drafting this bill, and it's beginning to get a lot of support statewide. It looks like, you know, we'll have to wait till it gets a hearing to really get a sense. I think there's some pushback from police unions concerned about losing control over those investigations and increasing distrust of police. But it looks like it may really go somewhere this year.
Well, Gil, three stories that will follow as they develop. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting me.
That was WPR reporter Gilman Halstead.
Now we'll check the headlines, and then we'll hear the latest on Apple's newest plan to potentially disrupt the tech world with Apple TV. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. This is Central Time. Apple TV was released back in 2007. They were trying to create a more seamless television watching experience, and it was kind of modeled on the other Apple products out there.
Well, they sold about 13 million Apple TV boxes. It hasn't been quite the hit that Apple's other products have been yet.
There's some news, though. Apple is trying to get together with TV content providers. Maybe they're looking to bypass cable altogether, kind of like Netflix.
And here to talk about this with us is Gina Chan. She's a former corporate reporter for Quartz. Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So Apple has been in conversation with television content providers at places like ESPN, HBO. What are they up to?
Yeah, well, the parties are trying to figure out if they could come to an agreement where these content providers like HBO and ESPN would be a part of Apple TV, which would actually be a TV set that would resemble, you know, basically a giant iPad and try to bypass the cable companies.
And this would be kind of the last blow for the idea of having a TV schedule, wouldn't it? I mean, it would be I'd have a TV with apps on it that I'd view, or is that how it would work?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. And, you know, consumers are already starting to move down that path with House of Cards from Netflix, and obviously DVR and TiVo, and, you know, more and more TV watchers are watching their programs on their own time, and this would be sort of the ultimate expression of that.
Now, ultimately, this is supposed to be a TV set that Apple is selling, essentially, right? It's not just going to be a box.
Yeah, no, exactly. They want to provide both the hardware and software, much like they do with the iPhone and iTunes, where basically Apple wants to own the whole experience. You know, if they just have something you can plug into your TV, then the TV may not work the way that Apple wants it to. So they really want to control the whole thing.
Do you think that this is what people want their TV experience to be like? I mean, Apple has gotten out ahead of markets before. Do you think they're onto something here?
Well, you know, this is a vision that Steve Jobs had before he passed away. He, you know, I think famously said in his autobiography that he felt like he sort of cracked the code for TV. And, you know, certainly consumers are looking for sort of that all-in-one experience, and especially younger people these days. You know, a lot of them don't even have TVs. They're just watching things off of their tablet or their laptop through streaming services. So TV is constantly changing, and it seems like, you know, the players who are important are changing as well.
Now, do you think that this could be, should it get off the ground, a game changer for the way that we watch television? Is it even television anymore?
Yeah, no, it would definitely be a huge change, especially for the cable companies. And I mean, some of the executives even start to talk about a sort of a distant future where they might not even be part of TV. They would more be just the internet service provider, And that's basically what an Apple TV set would do, where cable companies would just be another app on the Apple TV next to HBO, Netflix, Hulu, and others. Obviously, the demise of cable would be a long time coming. I don't think, even if Apple TV succeeds, that would happen right away. But, you know, they've definitely put, you know, pressure on the music industry because of iTunes, and, you know, they will change the TV industry as well.
So Apple is out talking to some content providers. Can you get, this is what you were reporting on, can you give us some examples of the kind of people they're going to, hoping to get them on board with this?
Sure. Well, it's interesting because Apple has basically concluded that they don't need everybody. They don't need, you know, the hundreds of channels that you have available right now in your cable companies, through your cable system. They feel that they only need to get enough of compelling programming that people, especially diehard TV watchers, would want to buy an Apple TV set. So that's why you have your obvious suspects of HBO and ESPN and others. The question is whether they can come to an agreement, because these content providers also have contracts with cable companies as well, who are obviously resisting Apple's efforts. So that's still a question of whether they can get enough content providers on board. But, you know, Apple is a very convincing negotiator. They've obviously had success in other areas. So we'll see how this one plays out.
Gina, who would be the big get for Apple? If they get this company on board, they're good to go. Because right now they don't seem to have that linchpin player in place. Who are they really wanting to snag?
Well, I think some of the sports channels, obviously ESPN would be a huge get. There's also the cable networks that have programming that people are obsessed with, whether it's HBO and Game of Thrones or Showtime. I'm guessing that AMC could also be in there with Mad Men and other shows that they have. So it's really those programs that everyone talks about, everyone's sort of obsessed with and needs to watch as soon as it airs. Those are really the ones that Apple needs to get, because if you get enough of those kinds of programs, then that would probably be enough to get buyers, especially sort of younger viewers who are already used to watching TV on their own terms.
Let's flip it around, though. Say I'm ESPN. I'm doing pretty good. I'm getting lots of money in my deals with cable companies. People are watching me. What's in it for me to jump on this Apple thing?
Well, that's the question of, you know, compared to the deals that they have now with cable companies, when they do get a lot of money in fees for that, versus what an Apple experience can give you. There's a lot of other things that being part of an Apple TV set where, you know, maybe you could pause it and just have various clips of highlights from a certain game. You could get stats of different players. You know, there's various other things that will likely come with an Apple TV set. Apple has also made certain small acquisitions. They're talking to an Israeli company that does motion control, where there's a sense that there could be some sort of gesture control as part of their TV. So if that becomes sort of the next cool thing that everyone wants to buy, then, you know, content providers like ESPN will likely want to be a part of it.
This is something that Steve Jobs had said he wanted to do. You know, he's gone. Do you have a sense of how much of this vision is his and how closely they're adhering to that vision?
Well, I think Steve Jobs definitely wanted to do this, and again said he had sort of cracked the code, but I think it's taken Apple much longer than the company thought it would, because this is a much more complicated industry than the music industry or the publishing industry with ebooks. There's a lot more players involved, where there's already set agreements that are difficult to get out of. So it's been much more complicated for Apple this time around than it's faced in other sectors.
And then just briefly, how are the existing cable providers reacting to this? Are they worried?
Yeah, no, they're definitely worried. I mean, Apple's been trying to talk to them as well. but they've been resisting because they feel like they will basically become, quote, a dumb pipe for Apple and just a conduit for them, much like, you know, AT&T has sort of become with the iPhone, and they don't want to be sort of, you know, pushed aside if they agree to this. So they're definitely pushing against it, but, you know, at some point they might just see, you know, the future and have to decide how much they want to be a part of it or not.
Any sense on the time frame, Gina, just real quick, about what we might see, what's going to happen with this?
Sure. Well, I've heard that, you know, Apple wants to get something by the end of this year, early next year. But again, it sort of depends on these contract negotiations, you know, what the content providers can get out of with their existing cable company agreements versus, you know, what Apple can offer.
Gina, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Gina Chan, our former reporter for Quartz.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll talk about how, although cities are becoming increasingly hip, they're also becoming increasingly childless as families move away.
And we'll hear from a guest who says we need to focus on putting the culture back in agriculture.
That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.